Hello, I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, Director of the Wabash Center. Welcome to Dialogue on Teaching, a Silhouette Interview. The Silhouette conversations are sparked from a list of standardized questions. We have the good fortune to hear firsthand from teaching exemplars about their teaching and teaching life. Today, our Silhouette guest is Dr. Mayon Tran. Dr. Tran is Vice President of Academic Affairs and Academic Dean with Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. Welcome, Mayon, to the conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for having me.
So let's get started with our 13 questions, right? So there are literally 13 questions. When you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. I feel like it's just yesterday that I was a child. What did I want to be? Not a teacher, surprisingly. I never thought that was just possible. I was a girl, and I grew up in a more conserving background, both culturally and religiously.
So tell our listeners. I know where you grew up. Tell our listeners where you grew up.
So I was born and raised in Vietnam, and our family was part of the CMA Church, the Christian Missionary Alliance tradition. My father was the pastor, still is, retired. And we grew up cradle Christian, cradle church bred. So I always imagined myself being a part of the church in some way. And the roles varied. And it was deeply formative. So it's all immersive teaching, immersive learning, right? But never thought of it as a distinctive role or thing that you had to train up to do, right? I think I just wanted to be a child of the church. Mm. And that's what led me to seminary, really, just to learn more about what it means to be, to have access to all these traditions and resources and knowledge. And of course, seminary just broadened all of that and blew that out of the water as well, right? But yeah, there wasn't really a role that, it was a way of being, I think, more than a role.
Okay, all right. Who was proud of you when you became a teacher?
My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, because he passed unexpectedly when I graduated from high school. And he knew then that I was headed towards a route of kind of studying more about the Bible and theology as a girl in that tradition for a life of ministry in the church. And there's kind of a budding notion of a teaching life that was part of that too, even though I really didn't know well to say I want to be, you know, an educator or a teacher or a professor, right? But he knew that, he saw that, and he took me aside. I remember he took me aside and said that that he wanted to make sure that I would be able to do something where I could stand on my own, my own voice, my own sense of authority, whatever that is. Uh-huh. And that was his way of affirming for me. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And giving you permission, right, to be who you were.
Yeah. Contrary to the stereotypes of the culture, right? Asian culture is very patriarchal, hierarchical. You know, the patriarch gives us his blessing, right, to the girl child in the family. It wasn't so much of that. I didn't experience it in that way in that moment. It was more like that he blessed something that both he and I and the family knew was just a new path. For me and for us. Yeah.
Who has influenced your teaching for the better?
So many people, I would say so many. I think they're different facets of myself and my sense of my still evolving sense of who I am as a teacher has been a bricolage of different people who've entered my life or whose lives I've entered, from the technicians, the skillful teachers, right, who knew how to create and design and produce and experience and whatnot. So the technicality of it, and then to the wise ones who knew, you know, the right words, right moment, or to, you know, kind of the right usage of quietude, right? All of that. It's just kind of a seasoned way of thinking about life and using life as curriculum. And then to the ones whose ways of being just demonstrated a sense of self and self-regard, right, in who they are. And so I think of each of those imagos, right, those characters and the persons behind them as think about what I need to draw on in any moment of teaching.
What has surprised you about teaching or the teaching life?
It's hard. It can be painful. But the unexpected encounters, the realization that learning has taken place, even when we don't realize it, the surprises, and all the, makes it all worth it. Mm-hmm. But it's painful.
What's a favorite nickname by which you were called by a loved one?
What I can share. Mm-hmm. Dragon.
You're gonna tell us more?
So layered meanings to that expression and that metaphor and that image. So there's the you know, it, within the Vietnamese tradition, the zodiac signs, you know, the 12 animals. So there are multiple dragons in our family, right? And so we have fun with those. Like, what animal are you? Right? Are you the goat, the monkey, the dragon, right? So have affinity to the dragon. But there's also something that I learned a number of years ago that has stayed with me, and then I invoke that a lot, especially in orienting students to the learning experience together. And there is expression in the old world maps, hic sunt draconis, here be dragons, right? And it was a designation for unknown territories. Beware, dragons live here, right? Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that those expressions used to refer to territories from whence my people come, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a warning of the danger that lies ahead. But it's you kind of, how do you turn it on its head as well? What's dangerous, you know, and how to debunk, deconstruct our assumptions of what's dangerous, what's unknown territory. And that as a guide, as a mantra to my own teaching life. So
Nice. What profession other than teaching would you like to attempt?
Dance, because I can't. I can't move for the life of me. But I've always wanted to. The arts. And I don't say that because I'm talking to an artist teacher par excellence. I've always tried to engage aesthetics and the arts in my teaching, and have tried more now than ever. Not only because I'm convinced that it opens up, you know, new ways of learning, portals of learning and discovery, but because it stretches me. It's my growing area, right? Mm-hmm. And so when I can learn something new, that means I know how to teach others to learn something new. And so I want to be a dancer, because I can't do it now.
Do you enjoy writing in longhand? And if so, what is your preference for ink pen or writing utensil?
I do enjoy writing in longhand. And over the last few years, especially since COVID, I've taken that up more and more. So I actually take notes in meetings and whatnot. I have a journal that I would take rather than my computer. And the pen of choice has become this particular variety, Sarasa fountain ink pen.
And for our listeners who can't see her, she held up her journal and the actual pen that's in front of her.
Yes, it's there's something about I think I read somewhere it talks about creativity oozing from our hands, right? Children, when they draw, they don't even think, right? But they're thinking as they're doing it, right? But it just comes so naturally. And I've become convinced that long handwriting does that.
What's your superpower?
I think I the I think I intentionally practice slipping into the background of an environment that I'm in so that I can actually ooze deeply into the worlds that the people who are in that environment might be occupying. So it's more than invisibility. It's more than
No, that's not invisibility.
It's more than metamorphosis, right? Being able to like, or shape shifting. I think I used to claim that, but it's just a transportation, teleportation. It's oozing in and out.
So that's connectivity.
Inactivity, you think?
If you're co-joining or adjoining with that which is around you deeply, that's connectivity.
Yeah, connectivity. Yeah, I thought I heard inactivity.
Not connectivity.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. And I think one of your superpowers, because I think you have many, I think one of your superpowers is your nimbleness, right? Which is akin to what you're describing, the ability to go from place to place, peoples to peoples, in diversity and in differences, and be a part of those places, to inhabit those spaces in ways that don't look awkward or cumbersome, but in ways that look, you know, familiar.
Yeah, no, I appreciate hearing that feedback because I think it takes practice, right? That's why I'm trying to practice doing that more, so that it's not just an instinct or an intuition, but it becomes a superpower.
What's your favorite cuss word?
I have developed a potty mouth. the longer I'm in this, I think I'm going a roundabout way. That's another superpower there that I take the circuitous route to get to where I want to be. I have developed a potty mouth, and I need to learn to cuss in multiple languages. That's one of my goals. But you know what's funny is that cornflakes is my word.
The aggressive C and K. Aggressive. So give me an example. Say it like you would say it.
I learned it from a high school teacher who said that every time he needed to cuss in public and in front of students, and he really couldn't use his choice words, he'll say cornflakes. So it stands for so many things.
It is a placeholder. I can see how it can be a placeholder. Okay. Next, how have you survived certain violences in teaching?
Great question. I'm actually teaching a class or being with students in a class this semester on the topic of violence. Mm-hmm. And so the word invokes so many layers of meaning for me. And to have experienced how different forms, different dynamics, different registers of violence do occur in the learning setting, in the classroom setting or beyond the classroom. Coping mechanisms. Just trying to think back to moments, right? To moments that I've actually lived through. I think hindsight teaches me a couple of things. One is I really have to maintain a steady sense of self, self-regard, and self-integrity. So that in that moment, it's not about being defensive. It's not being about, you know, going on the offense. It's about kind of quickly checking to see, you know, do I have a sense of self? Mm-hmm. And secondly, that will allow me with that sense of kind of grace to self, I can quickly extend grace to the other. Mm-hmm. Be it the offender or the ones who actually are experiencing the violence itself vicariously or right indirectly. And so how to extend grace or invoke grace or channel grace in that moment immediately, because that's what we all would need. And then it's drawing on whatever trick of the trade or whatever it is to really kind of call to pause, to almost call time out on our need to like move on or to fix the problem or to respond to that violence immediately. And just to kind of let everybody almost freeze frame for everybody and say, what just happened here? And let's enter it together, right? And so, you know, I can go on and on with other things, but you know, thinking back on the moments in which we've experienced deep hurt as learners together, me included, those things, when I am able to channel them or invoke them or exercise them, not in that order, but, you know, kind of scramble, it has proven to be redemptive for us or for me, at least, on the other side of it.
So that kind of leads into the next question. What healings have you witnessed or received in teaching or the teaching line?
So of the different ways to answer that question, I'm thinking of an encounter, an experience, an incident that I had that's picking up on your last question there. And so it was a story, real, if I can share it. It was a situation in which I'd said something that I thought was just kind of an offhand comment in class. As we were trying to break students into small groups, and I was trying to encourage students to get into groups that are unfamiliar to them so that they're not just pairing up with their buddies. But something that I said triggered a response in another student. And they just clap back at me real hard and say, how dare you say that? You know, you had assumptions and blah, 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 blah. And then it just kind of, we froze, all of us froze, right? And we were scared and I was scared. But what was healing for me in that is that I, you know, I'm not going to go into how I try to handle that in the moment, but after class, you know, getting into my office, closing the door and say, what just happened? What did I allow to happen? You know, sit with it, sit with the disappointment in myself, but then to try to remember how to re-channel grace, right, for myself and for the student. And I reach out to the student. I asked her, right, to process it with me, to share her experience. I actually invited her to co-write something that we could submit to Wabash together. Mm-hmm. on our learnings about that incident. We started it, but then we didn't finish it. But at the end of that semester, she was gracious enough to join me in composing with other colleagues that we invite on the topic of that class for that semester. We co-wrote a liturgy of communion in which she shared her spoken word. She wrote spoken word that was set to the communion liturgy that I had shared with the group. And students would they composed a musical piece that was the foundation for that liturgy. Mm-hmm. And we did it together for mm-hmm. one of the closing chapel services for that semester. And it was just powerful. It was healing, but it was redemptive for the two of us, for me, and for the class. And so I, because of moments and incidents and experiences like that, I just believe that it is possible and it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating in the use of ritual, right, mm-hmm. to create healing. I think that's marvelous.
Yeah.
What have you enjoyed most about the teaching life?
So I actually, I was just thinking back, in anticipation of this conversation. I was thinking about what metaphors do I use now to imagine, to characterize the teaching experience. And two things came to mind for me. One is a dinner party, and the other one is a travel seminar. So creating a class, preparing a class, setting the environment for a class is like putting together a dinner party where you anticipate who's going to come, what they're going to enjoy. And a Vietnamese dinner party is messy, is chaotic, it's over the top. You know, it's my mother's dinner party where, you know, we have food for 50 when we only invited five, right? And that's
I
the
have
joy.
that mother. I have
What?
that. I have that mother.
You
That I
have
know
that.
her.
And the 3 days that it takes, right? And the 3 days that it takes to clean up afterwards. I mean, that's exactly what preparing a class is like for me. But that's joy. That's enjoying, and to enjoy it together when the people are there, right? And then a travel seminar, right? Like going on a journey and packing for it, and knowing that you will always forget something, and you will show up being awkward and, you know, being out of place. But then knowing, you know, knowing when you're deeply immersed in the setting and you don't really realize where you are, you forget, right, your place, because you're totally in a different world. That's what learning is, and that's joy, right?
Last question. At the conclusion of your teaching career, not now, years and years and years from now, right? As you look then, when you're looking back over your career, what miracles will you have performed?
That's a great question. That's a fun question. Miracles, huh? So let me, I think categorically, for those who know me, I think there are three kinds of miracles that I wish I would have, that I would be able to think back. And recognize that I have contributed to them. The first is the kind of the Jesus spirit God kind of miracle of pulling the impossible out of nowhere, right? That the most difficult thing to learn to engage, the most difficult situation, right? Where educated hope is what's needed for a community or an individual to be able to cultivate, right? To come to the other side, that pulling the impossible out of that I've been able to, right, to contribute to.
Life pulled out of death.
Life out of death, resurrectional hope, right? That
Education out of miseducation.
absolutely, right? Resurrect somebody from or a community and myself from the death dealing forces through educational experiences. That's a miracle. The other is it's another kind of miracle, I would say, is and for lack of better concepts or traditions to draw on, is shamanistic, is channeling the powers of other forces, right? And it's, you know, channeling the spirits, the miraculous spirits of the ancestors, of traditions beyond us, before us, and that I'm able to have the wherewithal, the presence of mind, and the wisdom to be able to channel those miraculous interventions from sources all around us. That would be something to be proud of. And then I think the last category of miraculous is just really profane. To be able to go through, and here's a cuss word, like the shittiness of teaching, and to take it with grit and joy, I think that is miraculous.
Survival, right? Survival.
To outlive, right? To survive something is to outlive something, even if the situation, the forces, right, is determined to bury you in the profanity of life. No extraordinary power, right? That you're able to resuscitate something through no extraordinary power at all. I think that's miraculous.
And part of our human abilities, capabilities, if we would just pay attention.
Yeah.
That's what we do in the classroom, if we would just get to it. Dean Tran, thank you so much for your wisdom, right? For your insight and for your vulnerability, right? This was just so beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Westfield. Thanks for drawing things out of us with your way of of asking questions, evoking and provoking.
To our listeners, the Wabash Center website is the place. Look on our website for details about our regranting program, our educational resources, which includes blogs, an archive of all of our podcasts, our syllabi collection, as well as our journal on teaching. And also on our website is information about our cohort experiences, our workshops, colloquies, and roundtables. A special thanks to our sound engineer, Dr. Paul Myrie, and our podcast producer, Rachel Mills. The music which frames the Silhouette podcast is the original composition of Paul Myrie. Wabash Center for more than 28 years is exclusively funded by Lilly Endowment Incorporated. And we are out. How was that, Paul?